through these days, but next to that is to buy his books and to read them. And this always pleases the man. He gets a little royalty. It pleases us. We sell the books in our bookstore. And it pleases you because you get your money's worth when Roland Bainton's name is on the cover. It is possible to be a scholar and not be able to communicate. And we have scholars like this. You've had them yourselves. But it's possible, again, to have a communicator who is also a scholar. And Roland Bainton in the area of church history and Luther has proven that this can happen, with the result that people buy books that are paperbacks over the counter in terms of the hundreds of thousands. I guess in the case of Here I Stand, Martin Luther, it is over 100,000, right? How much over? 200,000?
650,000.
Well, that indicates that we are not exactly materialists in America that only want to save our money in order to go to a movie. We spend some of it on a book and very likely read it because somebody must have read it to have told the next person. We're very grateful that Dr. Roland Bainton, for 42 years, a professor of church history, 5 years since his retirement, he tells me, and he's been spending it the last 5 months in Japan, hardly retired. He's been going full blast, and he comes here where we keep him rather busy, too. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you. I don't know exactly how we shall proceed. That will depend upon what develops as I feel out your interests. I am to deal in general with the period of the Protestant Reformation. We might make a little survey of the various movements of the Reformation. We might center on Luther. We might lead into some of the contemporary issues. We'll see as we go. But today, I want to direct attention to the question as to why a situation should have developed in which the church needed to be reformed in the age of Luther. That is a different question from what needed to be reformed, though obviously they are related. The question is not just simply to look at the picture in Luther's day and say what was wrong, but how did it get to be that way? And this is not an unimportant question. Protestants are often inclined to say that needn't bother us. All of those faults were due to the Catholic Church, but we corrected them, and that's that. But after all, it's rather disconcerting to realize that Christianity could have been in Europe for 1,500 years, and that the man who pretended to be the representative of Christ, the vicar of God, and the successor of St. Peter could be a man who engaged in open sexual immorality, who led his own armies against Christian princes, and who even made alliances with the Turks against Christians. How do you get, even in 1,500 years, from Jesus Christ to that kind of a representative of Jesus Christ? Is there a law of degeneration in history? Are movements and churches bound to be like Adam, who will eat of the tree and fall? Is that what we mean when we say the church needs perpetually to be reformed? The expression is used, ecclesia reformanda, the church in the process always of having to be reformed. Is it constantly decline and renewal, decline and renewal? And what are the factors that bring about this decline? Are they all to be reprehended? Are some of them innocent? So now I want to engage in a little analysis of the factors which it appears to me have a bearing upon the decline of religions, and in particular, the decline of Christianity, and especially with reference to this period. One reason for decline, it seems to me, is, well, maybe you could call it psychological. It is this, that people find it very difficult to live for long periods of time in a very high state of emotional tension. That's true not only with regard to religion, but with regard to many varieties of experience. When I was writing a book on Christian attitudes to peace and war, I found an article by a man who in the last World War had seen many atrocities practiced by Americans in the course of the struggle. He wrote it up in an article in The Atlantic. I wrote and asked him whether I might quote. Well, he said, if you wish. But he said, it's 10 years ago now, and I don't feel as acutely as I did then. He said, if I did, I couldn't have kept going. He was just shattered by it at that time. But he said, I'm a journalist, and I've been in journalism for the last 10 years, and I've just sort of cooled off. But anyway, he said, don't quote me in such fashion that it will appear that I am just an enemy to our government. I told him I'd try to be careful on that score, but I thought it was very important to record how a man feels at the time the thing is happening. You don't want to take his feeling 10 years later. You want to take it then. But this brings us back to the point of religious experience. A conversion is an intense emotional upheaval, and that degree of intensity doesn't continue through life. One may spend the rest of his life telling about how he felt at the time and praising the Lord for having done it to him, but he's not repeating with the same overwhelming convulsion the kind of experience that came to him once. One finds in the New Testament itself a testimony toward a certain evolution of this character with regard to three churches. There was the Corinthian church. This church was highly ecstatic. The people talked with tongues in meeting. That is, anybody would get up and babble in an unknown tongue. They were all intensely excited. The Apostle Paul told them to cool down. Not only that, but they were disorderly at the Lord's Supper. They ate too much and they drank too much. And the Apostle told them not to guzzle and not to be gluttons, but to go and eat at home and come and conduct the Lord's Supper in an orderly way. Well, here was a church that was excited to the point of extravagance. Then we have the church at Rome, which had become stabilized and become interested in theology. It was investigating its theological presuppositions without any suggestion of the prior emotional upheaval. And then we have the church of Laodicea, which was neither hot nor cold. This sequence often is discoverable in religious movements, from an extravagant emotionalism to intellectualism to indifference. There is another cycle, and this has to do with the opposition of generations. Sons, very commonly, in one regard or another, are in conflict with their fathers. There are not many Isaacs who have been almost sacrificed on Mount Moriah who wish to be Abraham's and do the same sort of thing to their sons. An opposition develops against the parental pattern. And now, to be sure, sons in reacting against fathers often return to grandfathers. So in that case, you can get a certain rhythm. The father, the son, the grandson against the father, but going back to the grandfather. In that case, you'll get a kind of a seesaw pattern in the whole thing. And there have been religious groups which have maintained a continuity of their original pattern to a very remarkable degree. One thinks of groups like the Mennonites and the Hutterites, who have kept up a pattern of rigid simplicity, manual labor for 400 years. But they've done it partly because they have been aided by the persecution of the external environment. Nothing breaks down a religious group so much as friendliness. If the group on the outside is willing to fraternize, they begin to fraternize, and then the original pattern begins to disintegrate. I was talking with a Jewish friend about all of the schisms in Judaism. And I said, you know, what's necessary to keep you Jews together is for us Gentiles to persecute you. Well, he laughed a rather grim laugh. But it's true that opposition from the outside may hold a group together and help it to maintain its pattern. Although, again, it may cause violent breaks on the part of the young, who just break with the whole thing and go over to the environment. But the main point is that this conflict of the generations is often a factor in the departure from an original pattern. But then there are other factors which have a certain inevitability about them and a certain irony. Dean Ing once said that in religion, nothing fails like success. And it's very true that the successes of Christianity are often its undoing. Now, to begin with, there is success in expansion, that is to say, in the conversion of new members. And every time Christianity goes into a new culture, it has the problem of trying to win the adherence of that culture. In order to win, there has to be a certain degree of accommodation. Of necessity, one must speak in terms which are intelligible to these people, and one must have modes of behavior which in some regard tie in with that to which they are accustomed. This accommodation facilitates the winning of converts, but they come in with a whole pattern of previous beliefs, and they begin to reinterpret Christianity in terms of their previous beliefs until it's a question whether you've got anything more than a new set of names for the old practices. So expansion produces assimilation, and the assimilation may bring with it corruption. This may happen in the world of thought, where previous thought systems are taken over, or again, it may happen in the field of behavior. In fact, in every area of life, this may take place. And there is a certain inner necessity about it, because there must be intelligibility if there is to be communication, but communication has to be in terms that are understandable. But by reason of the fact that they are understandable, they may not convey what one means to convey. And so Christianity may be paganized in the process. Now, that's happened over and over again. The church in general has taken the attitude that accommodation was legitimate in comparatively unimportant areas, but not to be tolerated with regard to essentials. And that raises your question, what is peripheral and what is central? And you can have splits over that too, and they've occurred often enough. One group will say, here we stand, we can't go beyond that. And the other, well, they put the line a little farther down. Adamant at the core, flexible at the periphery, is the general principle. Well, now let us look briefly at some of the earlier periods of history before the Reformation and see how these processes worked out. In the very early period, Christianity was confronted by the religions of Palestine and of the Greco-Roman world. In Palestine, of course, it was Judaism. And in the Greco-Roman world, the ancient cults and the new cults called mystery religions. The first problem was how to relate to Judaism. The Apostle Paul said that the ceremonial law had been discontinued, though he did not abolish the ethical law. But there were some very serious problems with regard to the ethical law. Because in the Old Testament, with the approval of God, the Israelites sought to annihilate the Canaanites. And then you have the polygamy of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Slavery was a recognized institution. Samson committed suicide. Judith was responsible for tyrannicide. When the Jews left Egypt, they despoiled the Egyptians, just carrying off their goods, just a plain piece of robbery, if you please, and so on down the line. What were you going to do about all that? There was one man in the early church whose solution was, throw out the Old Testament altogether. Christianity is a completely new religion. He said, the God of the Old Testament was not the Christian God. He certainly was not the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. He was a malevolent, subordinate demon who made the world. And the world's bad. No good God would ever have made it. And as for the morality of the Old Testament, St. Paul said that you should not let the sun go down upon your wrath, and Joshua kept the sun up till his wrath went down. Therefore, we must abolish the Old Testament. Well, the majority of the church said, no, that simply won't do. There's too much there that's really magnificent. This man's name was Martian. He pointed out all the passages on wrath in the New Testament and all on mercy in the New. And one of the early church fathers replied to him and said, well, there's plenty about mercy in the Old Testament. For God is slow to anger and plenteous in mercy. And there's a good deal about wrath in the New Testament. Depart from me, ye workers of iniquity, into everlasting fire. So it's not as sharp a distinction as he maintained. But in general, what the church did was to keep the Old Testament and to spiritualize or allegorize the passages that they found difficult. The concubines of Solomon were so many virtues. And, of course, the more he had, the better. And the wars against the Canaanites were wars against the vices. And so on down the line, they found a spiritual meaning for all this. But there was a certain incubus attached to Christianity by keeping the Old Testament. Because at various times in Christian history, polygamy has been repracticed, revived. And they say, well, look at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Are you any better than they? And God was pleased with them. Why shouldn't you have more than one wife? And there was slavery. It was all justified out of the Old Testament. And as for the extermination of the Canaanites, all of those passages were used to justify the Crusades, and so on. So here was a desire to retain the continuity with Judaism and to persuade the Jews that Christianity was the true fulfillment of Judaism and to bring them into the fold. But the accommodation meant carrying over certain vestigial attitudes which were capable of being restored within Christianity. Now, the same kind of thing happened also in connection with the Roman tradition. Here, the big question was whether they should retain the classical literature. Could a Christian be a school teacher? It was a very real problem. That is to say, the teacher of a school which would be attended by pagan as well as by Christian children. Of course, he could give instruction to Christian children, but they were public school teachers who took in anybody qualified. Well, the textbook would be Homer and Virgil, and these told many stories about the gods. And the parents of these pagan children believed in it as religion. The Christian teacher would have to regard it merely as mythology. Well, he would be in a rather tight situation. One of the early manuals on Christian discipline says it were better for a Christian not to be a teacher, but if he can't find any other way of making a living, it may be tolerated. Well, here you see was an economic accommodation. But they felt very nervous about it. This points up another interesting point also, namely, that the conflict of religions is sharper between two religious societies than between a religious and a secular society, because there are more points of conflict. In our American society, there are not many points in which we come into direct conflict with the society or with the state, because most of our institutions don't claim a religious sanction. But in the ancient world, the emperor was a god. The hospitals were under the auspices of the god of healing, Asclepius. The cemeteries had religious pagan rites connected with them, and so on right down the line. So there was hardly anything, there were very few areas in which a Christian could operate without getting tangled up with paganism at one point or another. Why, take even sculpture. You'd think that was innocent. And there was no objection to sculpture as sculpture. But a Christian was not to make an idol. And most of the orders that came in to the sculptors were to make something or other connected with religion. In the persecution of Diocletian, there were some Christians who were willing to make an image of the sun. They thought that was all right. But it wasn't too obvious because the sun was worshipped. And Constantine, before he became a Christian, was a sun worshipper. And after he became a Christian, he kept a certain relic of the sun worship by calling the first day of the week the sun's day, Sunday. The Emperor Theodosius later on called it the Lord's Day. And it's a curious thing that in all the Latin countries today, it's the Lord's Day, from Dominus, Lord, Domenica, Dimanche, Domingo. But in the northern countries, we're all pagans. It's Sunday or Sonntag. It's the sun's day. That has its roots in ancient paganism. But the Christians said, oh, that's all right, because the Son, this means the Son of Righteousness with healing in his wings. So they spiritualized the Son and found it acceptable. And these sculptors went ahead and made the image of the Son. But then they were required to do something that was indisputably pagan, and they refused and were beheaded. So their making of the Son was not to save their lives, but they had drawn the line at that point between the fundamental and the peripheral. And they thought, well, God made the Son, and what the pagans think about it is their business. So we can do it. They were quite able to make whales and elephants and lions. Those weren't worshipped. But not only could they not carve a statue of a god, but they couldn't even put on a gilt ornament around it. It really restricted craft, the craft hour. There were so many things they couldn't do. Well, here are the conflicts that come in a non-Christian society. Of course, we haven't got them here. This is all talking history. They're alive enough in Asia right now. And you run into them very frequently in Japan, which is fast becoming a secularized culture, but among the common people still has a great many of the practices of Shintoism and Buddhism and so on. So there, it's a very live problem as to how far you will affiliate. For example, I was in the home of a pastor in a farming community of Japan. They still got a few dairies, but not many. He took us into his home, and he opened a little door. He said, this is the shrine of my ancestors, a little Buddhist shrine. He had no flowers. He had no food there. But he said, my ancestors for hundreds of years have knelt here in honor of their ancestors, and I'm not going to burn it up. But there are others who would say, you got to cut clean. You have that thing around, and you'll be worshiping your ancestors. Well, here's a problem in the missionary world today. How far do you have to cut clean? Can you keep some things after you've demythologized them? For you, or rather, you've made them, no, you've de-theologized them. They don't have any theological meaning. They have a mythological meaning for you. They're just myths, and you can keep them as myths. Now, the same thing has happened to Homer and to Virgil. We can teach them in our schools because we don't believe them. But when the religion that they talked about was a live religion, the conflict was much more acute than in our day when there isn't any conflict at all, because it's just a story. This was the kind of thing which the church was continually confronting. And they did say, here we stand on a great many points. Some things you cannot do, but on others they were willing to make concessions. I'll take just one more example. And that has to do with the marriage relationship. At the beginning of the third century of our era, around 220 A.D., there were more noble women in the church than men. A great many of the men were slaves, and the women were of the nobility. Well, the church wanted to keep marriage inside the religious community. But these women of the nobility were not willing to marry the slaves because in that case they would take the status of the husband. The church ruled that they might have the slave men as concubines. Now, the term concubine usually is applied to a man who has a woman who is not his wife, but it can be applied also to a woman who has a man who is not a husband. They said it is legitimate for them to be united on the basis of legal concubinage in the eyes of the Roman law, because the Roman law is not the law of God. Now, this union must be monogamous, and it must be one for the propagation of children, and it must be lifelong. But these are all of the essence of marriage. And the fact that legally it isn't marriage doesn't matter. In other words, the church set up its own law over against the law of the empire on this point. This is the beginning of church law as versus imperial law. The church will recognize concubinage, but the recognition of concubinage was to become a great evil later on in the Middle Ages. But then another problem arose, and here the church dug in its toes, because these women, having taken the men as concubines, didn't want to have any children by them. because the children would be slaves. So, contraception. And the Bishop of Rome came down on that hard. And from that day down to almost our own time, the Catholic Church has continued that opposition, which arose against not having any children at all. It was not the modern situation in any respect. The Church is just waking up to that. And by the way, there's a very fine history by a Jesuit. Nonan is his name, N-O-O-N-A-N, on contraception, who traces the attitudes of the Church straight down the line on this question and points out how, in this instance and in a number of others, the legislation of the Church was all directed against not having any children at all. So on that point, they were adamant. But at the point of legal marriage, they were flexible. So you see how they keep drawing the lines all the way along. Then there was the matter of religious festivals. The birth of Christ was celebrated for nearly 350 years on the 6th of January, and it still is in the Eastern churches. With us, that's Epiphany, Twelfth Night. A change was made around 350 A.D. to the 25th of December, quite deliberately, because that day was the birthday of the sun, the winter solstice. And the pagans regarded the sun as a deity and believed that he could die and rise again. He was reborn to eternity, Renatus ad aeternitatum, on the 25th of December, which was the solstice on their calendar. Later, a calendar change made it the 21st. But on the old Julian calendar, it was the 25th of December. The pagans all had a big celebration on that day. Or when that day came around, recent converts from paganism would go back and celebrate with their old friends. And maybe they wouldn't come to church next Sunday. So the Church decided they had to have a counter festival in order to keep the faithful within the fold. It's the same thing that's happened today with the Jews. I was on a panel with a rabbi one time to discuss Hanukkah and Christmas. And he said, you know, Hanukkah is not an important festival with the Jews, but he said, we're playing it up in order to keep our children away from yours. He said, we couldn't celebrate it with you on a non-religious basis. You wouldn't want us to. And we can't do it on a religious basis because we don't agree with you. So we're making a lot out of Hanukkah, though it's a very insignificant Jewish festival. Well, the same principle led the Christians to take the 25th of December in order to keep the faithful within the fold. But what happened was that they brought a good many of the practices that were associated with the pagan 25th of December into Christmas. The secularization of Christmas didn't begin with Woolworth. It goes back almost to the first centuries. And Easter, too. There were many who wanted... One of the problems with regard to Easter involved the relation to Judaism on the one hand and paganism on the other. The Easter came, obviously, at the time of the Passover, because that's when Christ was crucified and rose. And on the Jewish chronology, it was the month Nisan. But the Jewish chronology was experimental or observational. The month could not be more than 28, nor more than 30 days, with the result that it was always the lunar year was always getting behind the solar year, and when it was far enough behind, so that the lambs would not be old enough to be killed at Passover, they put in an extra month, an intercalary month, called Ve'adar. Now, when that was to be done was determined by the high priest of Jerusalem. Well, now, the Christians, for a long time, determined when to celebrate the resurrection of Christ by waiting for the high priest to say where the extra month went in. Well, were they going to be tied to Judaism like that? There was a big controversy over it in the early church. But if not, when then should they have it? Some people said we should have it on, not on a movable calendar, but immovable, and it should be the 25th of March, because that's the spring equinox. Well, there was a trouble with that, because that was the day of the resurrection of some of the nature gods who were believed to die in the fall and to rise in the spring. And it was very easy for one with that background to say that Christianity was just a nature dying and rising, a nature cult, that of a dying and rising fertility god who rose at the spring equinox. There was strong opposition to that, as there was not with regard to Christmas, and they wouldn't take it on the 25th. Instead, they combined all the elements. They put it on a Sunday because the Lord rose on the first day. After the first full moon, this kept the lunar element, which the Jews had had. After the vernal equinox, which revolves it around the pagan focus. So in the background of Easter, you have the Christian Sunday, the Jewish first full moon, and the pagan equinox. But certain pagan elements began to creep into the picture, namely symbols of fertility cults, eggs and rabbits. Now this goes back, you see, to the old idea that this is the rising and dying of a vegetation god. Incidentally, and this is a digression, I warn you, but I'll get back on the track. Lilies are extremely inappropriate for Christmas from that point of view, because the lily is the symbol of chastity. The angel Gabriel comes to the Virgin Mary with a lily. It's not appropriate from the point of view of the eggs and the rabbits, because this is chastity and the eggs and the rabbits are fertility. But the reason why it happened was that the Protestants rejected, the Protestants of the Calvinist tradition, the Puritans, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, rejected the whole Christian year completely, down to nearly 1860. They wouldn't have Easter at all. But when they finally came back to it, they wanted some flowers, and Bermuda lilies were in bloom, so they just took those. And so Bermuda lilies got attached to Easter, though they'd be much more appropriate for the Annunciation. I'm merely giving a few examples of the whole problem of accommodation. You dig in your toes at some points, and the Christians absolutely dug in their toes that Christianity was not a nature cult. Christ was not a personification of natural forces. He was rather... Christ and the Incarnation represents not a recurrent phenomenon of dying and rising, but a unique act of God in the course of the historical process, all history leading up to him, all history leading out from him. This is no vegetation cult. It is rooted and grounded in God's act in history. They wouldn't compromise on that, but they didn't care about eggs and rabbits. So here is your core and your periphery. But the periphery can often get pretty wide. And many of the abuses in the church have arisen from just this kind of situation. Well, then we come into the West after the barbarian invasions, and then came a new culture and a new process of accommodation. These people were lusty warriors. It's just amazing what the gospel has done to the Vikings. You find them such admirable people now, you know, all these Scandinavians, but they were a wild lot at one time. The Anglo-Saxons, too, they're in my background. They were a rough lot. Centralized government broke down. There were little principalities here and little principalities there. They were engaged in fighting off new invasions continually. One must bear in mind that Europe was under siege for 600 years. The first barbarians would come in, settle down, then some more would come in. Raids were constantly continuing. Europe did not arrive at a state of comparative tranquility until down to somewhere in the neighborhood of the 12th century. Under these circumstances, the code of war of the early church broke down. The pacifism of the first three centuries broke down. I could discuss the nature of that pacifism, but suffice it to say that no Christian leader down to the time of Constantine approved of killing in war. A Christian could be a soldier if he didn't kill. And he could, because during the 250 years of the Roman peace, there was practically no warfare, and the soldiers were the police force. But now in the Middle Ages, the whole code broke down. It was every man for himself. Of all people, the clergy were not supposed to fight because they shouldn't shed blood, but they used clubs and mashed the enemy without shedding blood. It was every man for himself. And Christ became a new Lord of hosts. Clovis was converted in battle. His wife had long been working on him to be a Christian, and he had stoutly held out. But when he was about to be defeated, he said, "Oh, Jesus, God of Clotilde, help me, and if you do and I win, I'll become a Christian." Well, Jesus helped him, and then he became a Christian and baptized his whole army by, well, I think pretty plainly, by sprinkling. One friend said it was a case of instant conversion, add water only. You find the militarization of Christianity. St. Peter becomes a warlord. St. Michael, Mont-Saint-Michel, the great fortress in Brittany. St. George of England, St. Andrew of Scotland, St. David of Wales, St. James, Iago of Spain. The great cry when they were fighting the Moors was for Santiago. We get the militarization of the saints and the militarization even of Jesus. The church becomes so immersed in its culture that it takes on its characteristics. But now there is another phenomenon at work. And here we come to another aspect of the failure of success. The first success I've been talking about is the success in winning converts. And when they come in without adequate preparation, because we ought to bear this in mind, that the conversion of Europe was by masses. There's debate about this in modern missionary circles. Is it better to bring in groups who can associate with each other, or individuals by personal conversion who then often are cut off from their ethnic enclave and have to enter into a European complex? But if they do come in by groups and without adequate personal preparation, they may bring this whole body of beliefs and practices in with them. So it was the success in winning converts by the thousands which meant really that Christianization followed conversion. Conversion was often simply a formal affirmation, and the real Christian education came afterwards. This then was the failure of success. But another was that piety attracts wealth. The church used money to redeem prisoners, to care for those in the plague, to found hospitals. We find this very, very early. St. Jerome turned his monastery into a hostel for refugees when the barbarians were coming in. And Fabiola, one of his female friends, established a hospital. There are many accounts of hospitals in the 4th century. And Julian the Apostate, when he rebelled against Christianity, commended the philanthropy of the Christians, their hostels and their hospitals, and wanted a pagan imitation of it. If money is used in such fashion, then there is the impetus to give. This itself is capable of corruption, because the philanthropy which is motivated by the concern for service can very readily become a device for winning one's eternal salvation by getting some credit with God. Philanthropy turns into work righteousness. But the main point here is that piety attracts wealth. By 590 AD in Italy, when Gregory the First was the Bishop of Rome, Italy was parceled between some of the old rulers and the new barbarians. The Lombards were in northern Italy. It's still called Lombardy. And they had various strips dotting the island. The disunification of Italy really runs from the Lombards down to 1870. It was split up in this fashion. The Emperor at Constantinople was unable to exercise any political control, and he had no financial resources. Rome had fallen from a population of 1.5 million to only 40,000. The aqueducts had been cut by the barbarians. Swamps had resulted. Malaria became a menace. The plague entered the city. The higher regions of Rome had become uninhabitable for the lack of water. And the ancient statues lay strewn upon the cobblestones, broken heads and arms and torsos. This was the Rome, Rome the Eternal, believed to be the glory of the world. Who was to take care of this whole situation? Besides, refugees were constantly pouring in from the north as the Lombards pushed against them. And in the previous centuries, the populace of Rome had actually been fed by the government. A very, very bad practice. But it had gone back to political elections in the early period of the empire, when one candidate would give panem et circensem, bread and circuses. Bread. They give a dole. They did that so frequently that the populace came to depend upon these doles, and so it was the government which had constantly bread distribution. Well, the government couldn't do it anymore. But the church owned properties in northern Africa, in Sicily, in Sardinia, forests in Calabria, other properties up in the area of Trient. All of this had come in by donation. Wealth following piety. And at this particular moment, the Mediterranean had not been yet overrun by the Mohammedans. It was the church which fitted out the vessels that brought in the grain supplies from northern Africa. The church which fed the populace of Rome. The church which dealt with the barbarian Lombards and out of its own resources ransomed prisoners. The state, the church, was, by reason of its resources, taking over some of the functions of government. Not as a conspiracy, not as a desire for power, but to do a job that nobody else was able to do. Piety had created wealth. Wealth was being used in an emergency. Well, now this problem of wealth came up again in new form after the barbarian invasions. For the great force in the converting of the northern peoples was, after all, monasticism. This was the most effective mode of operation, because one must bear in mind that a moneyed economy had broken down, and money in Rome would not do one any good in Gaul. Gregory I, this same pope, wrote to some people in Gaul and said, "There's no use sending me any money from Gaul. I can't use it down here." And the reverse was equally true. Consequently, the papacy, if we may use that term retroactively, or the bishopric of Rome, could not finance missions beyond the Alps. A missionary might take out a bag of gold on his back. He'd probably be robbed of it in no time. And anyhow, he'd soon use it up, and he couldn't get back to any mission station to get a new supply. He was on his own. The only way in which he could survive would be by gaining the patronage of a prince or taking a piece of land and making it productive. And for that, it required more than one man. In other words, a little group, a monastery. So the monasteries began to plant themselves in the forests to reduce forest land to agriculture, to drain marshes, to regain a territory, and made themselves self-sustaining units radiating out through the population. And then lands began to be given to them. And what was more serious, with the lands went the workers on the lands. This is the period of serfdom. And the monasteries accepted them. And the monks didn't have to do any more manual labor. They could devote themselves to scholarship or to less estimable pursuits. Piety had attracted wealth, and wealth was undercutting labor. And over and over again in the Middle Ages, we have attempts to get back to manual labor for the monks. The Cluniacs tried it. The Cistercians said, "We will not take any land with laborers on it, and we won't take any good land. We'll take the worst land that anybody will let us take." And they took lands, well, they took some cultivatable land, and they broke in a great deal more. The Cistercians made a real difference in the economy of Germany by the swamps that they drained. But the other thing they did was to take over such land that it was no good for anything but grazing. And they went in for raising sheep. And they raised more wool than they could wear. And they disposed of their wool on the market. And they became pre-capitalistic capitalists. And after a couple of hundred years, the Cistercians had become as wealthy as any of the other groups. Then in the 13th century came the Franciscans and the Dominicans. And Francis said, "We won't let this happen again. We will accept gifts, but only for one day at a time, and not keep anything over until the next day. We'll engage in manual labor if there's any to be done, and accept whatever is given. But no money. We'll take only clothes or food, and ragged cast-off garments of Umbrian peasants, or miserable food. It's got to be utterly poor. Naked we will follow the naked Christ." Well, that's all right if you've got only about a dozen people. But the order grew. When they came to have about 500, it was difficult to do enough begging each day to supply the entire group. They found some people were better beggars than others, so they began to specialize. And they had no refrigeration, of course, so it was hard to keep food very long. And so they began to admit a little money. And when one monk was seen handling it with gloves and a stick, another one reproached him for having anything to do with this filthy lucre. He said, "Well, wait till you've got 500 bellies to feed." So they had to make some kind of a concession. And the leaders of the church, who respected the work that they were doing as preachers and evangelizers and reconcilers, said, "Now, let the church own the property and give you the use of it." In other words, they practically promised them a continuing income. They could be relieved of the onus of ownership, but could be guaranteed the produce from it. So most of them accepted that compromise between dominium, which is ownership or lordship, and usus, which is the use of it. Then there was a split in the Franciscan order, and that's a long story. But the point is how this problem is recurrent. One of the monks formulated the law in this way. He said, "Piety creates industry. Industry creates wealth. Wealth destroys piety. Piety in its fall dissipates wealth. And the cycle starts over again." This, he said, is the law of monasticism, this continual rhythm. Well, we certainly do see this process going on repeatedly. Now, another aspect of it is political. I indicated very briefly that Gregory the First took over what were essentially political functions and used all that wealth to do things which had been done hitherto by government. This process continued until the papacy became the ruler of a section of Italy, and popes actually had their own armies and fought with various princes in Italy. They also engaged in political machinations and tried to set one kingdom against another, depending on whether or no it would be favorable to the papacy and its policies. The papacy was being turned into a secular civil state, although it was constantly striving to permeate the whole of society with Christian ideals, and then is itself becoming conformable to the secular standards. The church began to interfere with politics, first of all in the interests of morality. A king, Lothair by name, in the 9th century, put away his wife and took a concubine. The church excommunicated him. The fight went on for a long time, and finally he submitted and returned to his wife. Interferences on moral questions were rather frequent. But by and by, the church began to use excommunication against those who didn't pay their rent on lands owned by the church, and it became a racket for raising money. So one thing moves over into another. Then came, in the 12th century, a great reformatory movement which said it's necessary to reform the church, to reform the whole of society. This must be drastic in character. For Christianity can never come to terms with the world. Either it must withdraw to the desert like the early hermits, or else it must impose its will upon the social structure. This is, after all, by command.
This led to intense conflicts with the civil power. It entailed an attempt to make the clergy a body independent of the secular power by instituting clerical celibacy. And that didn't come until the 11th century. Hitherto, the bishops had been married. The bishop was called episcopus, and the bishop's wife was episcopisa. His sons would often succeed him, and bishoprics became hereditary dynasties. And the kings in the various regions, inasmuch as the bishops were also lords and princes and exercised temporal domain over large areas, required a loyalty on the part of these retainers, so that these bishops had their own armies, which they supplied to the king on demand. They raised money from their retainers, and they gave to the king what they chose. They were geared into the total structure of the life of Western Europe. And the papacy thought one way to break that up would be to give up marriage for the clergy, and in that case, there'd be no hereditary succession, and every appointment would have to be made afresh with papal approval. Neither should popes anymore ever be made by emperors, and they instituted the body of the cardinals in the 11th century to elect the popes. It goes back only to that period. Many of the characteristics of the church that Luther faced were only about 400 years old, and they were connected with this great Gregorian reform. But the sad thing about it is that so many of the reforms misfired. Clerical celibacy ended in clerical concubinage. The attempt to control politics involved the papacy so completely in politics that by the time of the Renaissance, it was hard to distinguish the Pope from a secular prince. The church made a valiant attempt to suppress feudal warfare. There was the peace of God and the truce of God. The peace of God required the truce of God required that you should not fight on Friday, Saturday, Sunday during Lent, during holy days, so that fighting was reduced to a summer sport. And the peace of God required that you should not attack merchants, pilgrims, travelers, farmers, mules, agricultural instruments, or women traveling without their husbands, unless it's their fault. These were some of the promises that were made, but they weren't kept, so the church raised an army to suppress the peace armies. And the church's army got out of hand, and the kings had to raise an army to suppress the church's army. Human nature is rather difficult to handle. Then in the year 1095, Pope Urban II at the Council of Clermont had a great concourse of French nobles before him, and he started out with one of the traditional peace speeches of the last 50 years, telling them how frightful it was that Christian princes should be devouring one another. "Cease shearing one another like sheep, and go against the infidels in the Holy Land." And they said, "Dieu le veut, God wills it." And the peace crusade had ended in the crusade against the Turks, which in the end became a byword in Europe, and a good many people were saying, "Deus non vult, God doesn't will it." This is the sad thing about so many movements that start out with high hopes. They may achieve a portion of their objectives, but they are so often corrupted in the process. Celibacy becomes concubinage. The control of the world by the church ends in the worldliness of the church. The attempt to bring about peace in Europe is achieved by a foreign war, which did indeed bring about a sense of European unity, but at what a price. Then came the revolt of various sects. For 200 years before the Reformation, there was a constant succession of sects, and the church at the pinnacle of its power found its structure being split and had recourse to force to hold people in the Inquisition in the 13th century. And one of the saddest things about it all is that the methods used by modern dictators to brainwash and to break down opposition are only technological refinements on what was done in the name of Christ by the Inquisition. To think that one could get from Jesus, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do,"
to burning a man at the stake for the sake of his eternal salvation. These are some of the appalling anomalies of the history of Christianity. Now, I don't want to overdo it. I once did a little sketch of Christian history, and a friend looked it over, and he said, "Why, my dear fellow," he said, "you do believe in the church, don't you?" "Yes, I do. But I do believe in history, warts and all." And if we're going to understand the Reformation, we've got to understand that there was something to be reformed. And if we're not to become complacent about the Reformation, we have to inquire whether the same forces have been in operation again, and ask ourselves whether perchance that which was achieved in the 16th century has gone through some of the same process. Has it or hasn't it? There needs to be a continual re-examination of our whole history in terms of the cultural environments, a reassessment of the question of the fundamentals and the periphery, a constant re-inquiry as to whether we belong to the enthusiastic church of Corinth, or the theological church of Rome, or the indifferent church of Laodicea, or whether perchance there is possible a certain combination of these elements. Well, now this leads us up to the Reformation, and I'll try to reform us next time. I haven't let much time for discussion. I might inquire whether you would like to proceed in this fashion. Would you like to stay primarily with the Lutheran Reformation? Shall I try to go beyond that, or have you any feelings on the subject? Or shall we just grow as we go, like Topsy? Pardon me?
You do what you want so much
fun. The trouble with me is I don't want to be stopped. That's another of the corruptions. I'll try to be temperate. It's time to close now. I'll try to be temperate and leave some time to discuss the issues next time. All right.